Remember Counting Crows? Jeez. Nate, were you in the Counting Crows?
No, I thought they were not that cool. I mean, like...
Wow.
Is that surprising?
Too cool for Counting Crows.
I mean, they were different phases.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Former Vice President Joe Biden announced his candidacy for president last week and quickly jumped to the front of the pack in the competition for endorsements, according to our tracker. He also raised more money than any other 2020 candidate in the first 24 hours after his announcement, according to his campaign. So today we're going to dig into the initial reactions to Biden's candidacy, as well as the role that the establishment is playing in the 2020 Democratic primary. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Going good.
Good to hear. And Senior Politics Writer Claire Malone. How are you, Claire?
I'm good.
Fabulous. And also with us is Managing Editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
I'm good. I have that Counting Crows song stuck in my head
Long December.
Take it away, Nate. Also today, a recent Emerson poll showed that a quarter of Bernie Sanders supporters would support Trump over Elizabeth Warren if given that option in November 2020. We're going to ask whether or not that's a good use of polling, and also why we don't see more overlap in support for Sanders and Warren in general. We'll also answer a few listener questions. Before we do any of that, I should also mention that 1 week from today, we will be in Austin, Texas. Tickets for that show are sold out, unfortunately. But if you want to catch us in Houston, Texas, next Wednesday, May 8th, you can head to 538.com/live for details and tickets.
Yeah, Houston needs to step up. You cannot let Austin look better than Houston. Houston's a bigger city.
Come hear us debate the question that people in Texas love
are
to
sick
hate.
Of, yeah.
Will Texas turn blue? Thank you very much.
All right, but let's begin things with Joe Biden. According to the indicators that we track, say polling, endorsements, fundraising, how was Biden's kickoff?
Good.
Fine.
I think everything was kind of in line with expectations. But the expectations should be that things are pretty good because he is the front runner. Front runner does not mean that you're guaranteed to win. In fact, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're even 50-50 to win. I don't think anyone's even that close to 50-50 to win. I do think, though, that like Joe Biden is the obvious front runner for the nomination, and that people are trying too hard to pretend that it's a co-front runner between him and Bernie, and it's not, right? I mean, Biden's polling at about 28% on average, whereas Bernie's at about 20%. Biden has the most endorsements in the field.
Or at least most weighted endorsements, according to how we assign points on our tracker.
However you
Ooh,
look at it.
Shots fired at our however point
you,
system.
However you look at it, his endorsements are a lot more impressive than anyone else is in the field, in part because they have come a lot from outside of state. And granted, like Delaware is a tiny little state, right?
I thought anyone. I mean, I kinda, anybody up there with Rhode Island.
I'm not cute little state.
Cute little
I'm not
state.
Totally sure why Delaware is its own state. Just
Oh my God. Wow.
No, I mean, come on, just merge it into Pennsylvania
for corporate reasons. Lots of corporations there.
Delsylvania or something, right? Should be kind of one state.
The Pennsylvania Dells.
Actually, as a PA native. That would give us some beat Trump property. I would take that.
Yeah, why? I mean, again, if we have to purge some states, merge the Dakotas, merge Delaware into Pennsylvania. There's the two
it's
easiest.
Such
we don't have to though. But here's the thing: I thought Biden's kickoff was consistent with his status as a relatively weak front runner.
Okay, so yeah. We talked about polling and endorsements. The other big thing is fundraising. Would you say that established him as a weak front runner? His
Yes.
You know, record-breaking or whatever, first 24 hours?
Yeah, he raised, what was it, $6.3 million in the first 24 hours, which is marginally more than Beto O'Rourke raised, which is marginally more than Bernie Sanders raised. So it's like he's the front runner, but marginally.
So as you said, Micah, Biden raised $6.3 million, but that was from about 96,000 people. Sanders' $5.9 million, for example, came from about 223,000 people. Should we make anything of the difference between, you know, 90-something thousand and 220-something thousand?
I think it's interesting. I know it's become this new... Like, listen, money is money, obviously. Money is money.
And you got to pay your staffers, money's money.
Analysis.
Hashtag analysis.
By the way, I'm going to sidebar the way Nate would sidebar. And my sidebar is to say, I had a vision in Nate's last tangent of what a Nate Silver show would be like if it was just like one of those talk radio shows where you had like an hour to fill and like you were just kind of talking to yourself. I think you would be so good at that, but it would be such an esoteric mishmash of shit. Okay, anyway, I think
he got to if we had to eliminate states within 30
exactly,
seconds.
Exactly, that's what I mean. It is nutty. Anyway, I think the small fundraising number is interesting. I think this is one of the first elections where it's become this sort of standard metric. I do think that Biden is a front runner, a favorite for lots of reasons, because he has name recognition, all that stuff, but in part because he does have establishment power. I think Sanders' power, as we obviously saw in 2016, did come from a grassroots movement. It's notable and helpful as we all kind of like grasp around a little bit in the dark to have numbers like those. Now, Beto O'Rourke's team, the way that it was presented was slightly misleading. So there can be sort of...
Well, that's the thing is like whenever I have to give anybody traffic numbers for 538 for like a particular story, you know, I can give them page views. I can give them unique visitors. I can give them engagement time, time on site. I think the same is true with these fundraising numbers where you can kind of slice them, dice them whichever way you want. From the press release, it's often hard to tell what's what. But like, if you think about it, Biden raised marginally more than Sanders and O'Rourke from a smaller base. That kind of matches with what you would expect in that he's a bigger candidate, but kind of more insidery and probably a little more dependent on big donors.
And as we've talked about in the past, FEC filings happen every quarter. So
yeah,
we don't know the specifics behind the numbers that Biden gave us, but we'll find them out halfway through the year.
I feel like none of these numbers are that impressive.
See, this is your take. I don't agree with this.
Okay, but give us your take.
100%. So Sanders raised the most of any Democrat in the first quarter. He raised $18 million. Do you know how much Sanders raised in March, 1 month of 2016?
How much?
$44 million.
Okay, so Sanders, when he's running one-on-one against Hillary Clinton, raised more than Sanders raising against 20 other candidates.
Yeah, but like last time Bernie didn't win, and this time he's raising half as much and he's polling half as well. So I don't understand why people are like not like, oh, actually, this campaign's not doing that well.
So you're talking specifically about Sanders. Are you also making an argument about everybody's fundraising?
Bernie's numbers are more impressive than Biden's because Bernie's are going to be more sustainable with that larger...
With small donors.
With that small donor number. It's still not that good. And Biden's isn't that good, and Beto's isn't that good. And Trump's at 30 million is also not that good. Like, none of these numbers are that impressive. And I feel like I'm being, like, gaslighted by people like, oh, my God, Bernie has so much money. It's actually not that good.
Hold on. Should we care about the small donor numbers? Should we just be looking at the big numbers because that's all that counts because it's a 20-person race?
I feel like we've used this analogy on the show before, right? But there's some axiom called, like, Goodlatte's Law or something where once you begin to use a metric as a measure, it becomes a less meaningful measure. So the fact that all these candidates now, partly because it's become fashionable, partly because it's a way you qualify for the debates, if you're a smaller candidate, have tried to just kind of get donors in the door for $1, $5, right? Like at that point, the cost of acquiring a donation is like more than the actual money itself. So the hope is that they are now on your list and you add to your list and you build your list and they donate in the future, which is valuable. But it's different than actually having money, right? You don't make money off a $1 donation net. And I think it just got a little bit over-indexed. I mean, like, it's other things being equal, you'd rather have a higher per donor average. You'd rather have more donors and a higher per donor average. It's almost gotten, like, skewed now where it's like, oh, you have a low per donor average. Well, great. Well, okay, I'd rather have my more money. You know, I'd rather have more money and not have the nice headline in Axios.
So you want both. You want both the most donors and each donor giving the most money.
Yeah.
But just to clarify, because your main point was that you don't think anybody's raising all that much money.
No.
How much money do you think one of these candidates should be raising in a month or in a quarter? What would be your expectation?
I would think if the top totals were twice as high across the board, I would be impressed. If Bernie had raised $36 million since his launch, then I would say, okay, not as much as $44 million in 1 month, but that's pretty good.
All right. You heard it here first.
And he's the best.
Nate Silver says there's not enough money in politics.
No, I'm saying the money is consistent with a wide open field in which no one is out to that formidable advantage.
Okay.
Right.
That makes sense to me. So let's talk a little bit more about Biden specifically. How did the other candidates in the field respond to him getting in the race?
Well, I think notably Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders both fundraised off the Biden announcement, basically being like, look at Joe Biden. establishment, big money guy, please send us donations because we're the candidates of the people. We need those small dollars to fund our campaigns. So, I mean, Sanders is sort of second in polling, has a big reason to sort of take swipes at him that way. For Warren, that's very much in keeping with her campaign in general. Those were the most notable things I saw.
Yeah, I get Elizabeth Warren's emails, so I'll just read straight from this. It says, how did Joe Biden raise so much money in one day? Well, it helps that he hosted a swanky private fundraiser for wealthy donors at the home of the guy who runs Comcast's lobbying shop.
Burn.
Yeah, as the kind of front runner, if only a weak front runner, you would expect the other candidates to go after him now that he's in the race. I think you saw that.
Trump did.
Called him Sleepy Joe.
Not his best work.
No, it's not good at all.
Not his best work.
And also some outside groups were a little more aggressive than the actual candidates.
But that's normal, you know.
It's normal, but like it's not necessarily, you know, I think there's a version of Biden in which he's a true consensus front runner, in which you don't have Justice Democrats, which was the group that was behind AOC and a lot of the other kind of new, very liberal left members of Congress, and also had a lot of failed attempts to nominate his candidates. But they kind of came out very forcefully against Biden. And while that does not represent the center of the Democratic Party, it maybe is a good way to represent the 20% leftmost younger Democrats. And like, that's sort of meaningful, right? It means Biden's probably gunning for 80% of the coalition, not 100%. And that matters at the margin.
Sure. We know Biden is not a Clinton in 2016 level front runner. So we shouldn't like keep dinging him for not being that, if that makes sense. Like, we know he's only going after 80% of the party, right? Didn't we know that before Justice Democrats or whoever attacked him?
Yeah. No, I think everything about Biden has gone to form, sort of, right? Including, like, there were somewhat mixed signals about the endorsements because, on the one hand, he's clearly the closest thing to, like, a next-in-line candidate from the establishment's point of view. Bernie can make that argument, too, but obviously he is somewhat anti-establishment. On the other hand, the fact that so many candidates ran was not a great sign that the party was hugely behind Biden.
Right.
The fact that, like, you would have Obama world people interviewed, and there was some reporting out over the weekend saying Obama didn't actually encourage Biden to run in 2016. Now it's a different year, right? But you don't see, like, obviously what you saw for Clinton or Al Gore or something.
I liked how Biden was like, did you see the Biden quote where it was like, I asked Obama not to endorse me.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
It was a good meme. I think that's a good point, Nate, about just the number of people in the race takes away Biden's status in some way of, you know, there's no preordained person. And I do kind of wonder how the past two election cycles, 2016 on the GOP side and this election cycle on the Democrat side, being so populated with candidates, if we are entering a period of American politics where we're just not going to see those kind of preordained, okay, it's their time candidates, you know, whether or not this is going to become the new normal.
No, I think you're totally right. I think in contemporary politics, it is harder to pull off the next in line. I think voters are just less sort of willing to swallow that medicine. But if someone asked you, is the Democratic establishment behind Biden, what would you say?
I would say a portion of it is.
I'd say a portion of it is. I would say a lot of people are on the sidelines. I would say there are pockets of support, but not more than pockets for some of the other candidates. I mean, I do think, like, if I'm Kamala Harris, on balance, I think the campaign's going
well.
Well.
Yeah.
Well doesn't mean great, but well, right? But maybe I'm a little bit frustrated that I have not had a lot of people outside my home state line up and endorse me, because I can make an argument that, hey, look, you know, if it's not me, you're going to be stuck with Biden or Bernie, and like, it's not a great choice for anyone in a party that's full of people of color and full of women, right, and full of politicians who are not 76 and 77 years old, right? And so, or Mayor Pete, okay, maybe we'll see if that lasts, right? But if you want a good, solid candidate who can win the nomination and represent the entire Democratic coalition, I'm kind of like the first train leaving the station, and it won't be long before I'm the last train leaving the station.
I want to dig into a little bit more of how the establishment is thinking or how it's strategizing in the 2020 Democratic primary. Parts of the establishment are behind Biden. Did the party learn anything from 2016 on either the Democratic side or the Republican side in terms of how they should express their preferences or behave themselves during the primary?
I think they may have learned some of the wrong lessons. Again, I think I've said this on the podcast before. If not, I've tweeted it, I'm sure. I think Democrats are making a mistake by having a system that you remove superdelegates where it's very hard for someone to actually get a majority of delegates in a divided field without there being actually like a brokered convention. You know, I think they should have a system. I think the lesson of 2016 should actually have been that, like, you need to allow candidates to gain more momentum because it's going to get very messy.
I'm more specifically interested in how the party behaves itself in the run-up to the actual voting in the primary, during the primary. We talked a lot in 2016 about whether or not the Republican Party establishment was weighing in.
There are reports that the establishment, quote-unquote, whatever, you know, Democratic insiders are worried about Sanders. But I'm not really all that convinced they can do anything about it in the same way no one was able to do on the Republican side anything about Trump. I mean,
why?
Because what levers do you pull? You can endorse another candidate.
I've been thinking about Obama's role in all of this down the line, because in some ways there isn't a lot of, in recent history on the Democratic side, there isn't a lot of like similar situations to this, because Bill Clinton, being a former Democratic president, like, of course he endorsed his wife, you know.
So there wasn't a neutral.
There wasn't a neutral arbiter, kingmaker role. And I've been thinking about this more and more, which is Obama is acutely aware of the fact that the Democratic Party is moving in a lot of different directions. And I kind of wonder if he'll weigh in maybe sooner than people might think. I don't think he's going to weigh in for a while at all. But I'm kind of curious about what he would see his role as being, or what the Obamas do with their incredible amounts of power within the party. Michelle Obama as an endorser or as a surrogate would be an interesting person. So I'm kind of curious about whether or not at a certain point there are these figures in the party who say, listen, enough is enough. We need to coalesce. This is going on too long. We watched the GOP in 2016. They tore themselves apart.
I guess I could see that, but it would happen very late, right?
Maybe, maybe not.
I don't think Obama or any other really big-name Democrat could try to put too much of a thumb on the scale before a bunch of voting has happened. I think it just looks too bad. And so I think that could happen, but it would happen in the context of the end stages of the primary when you're down to two or three candidates. Let's say it comes down to Sanders, Biden, and Elizabeth Warren, right? Then I think you could see the party bigwigs come out and say, okay, guys, this is, we're tearing ourselves apart. We got to rally behind Biden. Or maybe we're tearing ourselves apart. Warren is the compromise candidate. The thing is, though, is like at that point, a lot of voting has already happened and the electorate kind of has a will of its own.
We're getting pretty far out in this conversation, but to wrap up here, does it seem clear that the establishment has decided one way or another this point in the race?
No.
No, although I think they have, I mean, I guess they've decided not Sanders, right?
No, and in a way they've decided we're not going to try to, I mean, if they were going to try to engineer this for Biden, you do that up front.
Yeah, first of all.
That's why it's good for Harris. That Biden didn't come out with 200 endorsements is really good for Harris. That's why we say Harris is good with how this is going so far. So they have decided not to try to.
Well, it'd be better for Harris if she had 200 endorsements, right? I mean, look, to some extent, it would be foolhardy for the establishment to like tag their candidate right now because they don't know how people are going to go over with voters. There have been no debates yet. No one's voted yet, right? We haven't really gotten deep into the weeds in terms of attacks and counterattacks and whatever else. And so suppose that Cory Booker turns out to be a really formidable candidate that people like and can get behind and balances the different wings of the party. But the establishment went all in on Joe Biden, and therefore Booker never has the resources to get that opportunity. And Biden proves to be a paper tiger and loses to Sanders, which is what they don't want, right? You would much rather get more information from voters about kind of what their preferences are.
Decided not to decide.
All right, let's move on to support for Sanders versus Warren and where there is and isn't overlap. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs flexible workspaces for businesses of all sizes and industries. WeWork's versatile agreements starting at month to month are dictated by the unique needs of your business. Moving in is so easy, you'll never want to move out. You can enjoy complete peace of mind knowing you can expand and contract your physical workspace without constraint. On-site community experts are dedicated to helping member businesses get the very best from their teams. All day-to-day operational needs like IT, maintenance, and cleaning are handled by WeWork, allowing you to focus 100% of your time on building the future of your business. WeWork understands the dedication and time it takes to build brand identity and company culture. Because of this, WeWork's private offices, designed for teams of up to 250 people, come with a range of customizable options to make the space truly your own, so you can work where you want, but stay who you are. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you or find out more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. Today's podcast is also brought to you by SelectQuote. If you're thinking about life insurance, did you know that the older you get, the more it costs? That's why locking in your rate for up to 10 or 20 years now makes sense. The rate you lock in won't change even if your health status does. If you think you can't afford it, chances are SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. SelectQuote comparison shops up to 10 highly rated companies, including Prudential, Banner Life, and Mutual of Omaha, as well as others, to find the company with the best rates. For example, SelectQuote could find a 35-year-old man a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month, or a 37-year-old woman a $700,000 policy for under $22 a month. Let SelectQuote save you time and money. Get your free quote at selectquote.com/538. That's selectquote.com/538 for your free quote. It's the numbers, not the letters. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors, and it's not available in all states. Don't put off protecting your family another day. selectquote.com/538. We're back, and one might expect that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren would share supporters, or at least be competing over the same batch of voters, given their progressive economic policy positions. But are they? So you can maybe think of this segment as an extended good use of polling or bad use of polling, because that's how the idea began. But then we decided we want to broaden out the conversation a little bit beyond just the use of polling. But let's begin with the poll in any case. So an Emerson poll came out earlier this month with one data point that was particularly notable, at least to Forbes. Forbes made a list of the, quote, five weird items in the poll, and one read, 26% of current Bernie Sanders supporters said they would rather vote for President Donald Trump over Senator Elizabeth Warren if that were the eventual 2020 matchup. Several of our listeners flagged that for us. First off, Nate, is that a good use of polling?
So this poll had a fairly small sample size, and I think it'd be better to get that number averaged across a number of different polls. For context, somewhere between 10 and 12%, depending on the poll, of Sanders voters in 2016 voted for Trump in the general election. And I think about an equal number either did not vote or voted for a third party candidate, which is actually not that high. It's, I think, pretty similar to what Clinton voters did in the 2008 general election between Obama and McCain. Remember, however, Bernie got 43% of the vote in the Democratic primaries in 2016. He has about half that, 20% this year. So if the more hardcore people are remaining within that 20%, and the people who are more open to any Democrat are now potentially leaving for another Democrat, then it would make sense that the core Sanders supporters that he keeps when he's quote-unquote only at 20% are including a lot of people who are anti the Democratic Party, who are certainly anti like the Hillary Clinton version of the Democratic Party, and who might not vote for the Democratic nominee in the general election. However, again, if Bernie only gets 20%, he doesn't win the nomination. So he has to kind of, again, reach out and expand to Democrats who like the Democratic Party and who also like Bernie.
So I think the theory of lanes, which is that there are distinct preferences within the party and you can kind of group voters into separate lanes, would say that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren would be competing over voters. If you disagree with that premise, also say that you disagree with it. But are they? That's one piece of data. What does the other data say?
But I don't think this data disproves that they share voters.
So it definitely doesn't. It disproves that they share some voters.
Well, yeah. But if you looked at the poll, you know, it was 21% of Bernie supporters say they would rather vote for Trump than Pete Buttigieg. So it's like all you're basically seeing is what Nate said, that there's this core, relatively small actually, share of Bernie supporters who are Bernie or bust and are just like, you know, I don't identify with the Democratic Party. It's just Bernie. I don't think we have a ton of data yet to show that Warren and Sanders share a ton of voters. It's more theoretical and maybe doesn't even exist. I know.
Because they share ideologies. But their performance of it is different, is very different, which I think,
yes.
Which I think maybe gets to some of like the reason why we're talking about this, about whether or not they share voters. I mean, a couple of things. You know, Sanders obviously has a movement of support that he carries over from 2016. He has a brand with, obviously, as we've been talking about, these kind of core group of people who just hate the establishment and would vote for Trump if given the chance, that kind of thing. And I think that goes to Bernie's real power as a polemicist, right? He does these barn burning events, that kind of thing. So he has that sort of a little bit of like the angry outsider thing going on, which Trump did have on some level. I think Warren, you know, similar worldview in a lot of ways with some important differences. I think her appeal is almost to what I've called in the past the Hillary Clinton primary voters, which is to say, like, maybe more college-educated, urban, millennial types who are in some way annoyed by Sanders or think that she is sort of like the smarter version of, I mean, again, she wouldn't call it democratic socialism, but that kind of idea of regulated capitalism.
Bold progressivism or something like that.
Right. But yeah. I think that like the Bernie supporters could make the argument that he has greater electability potential because that people, I've heard tons of people say this, which is she's very qualified. She might be more qualified than he is, but people don't want to vote for her because
she's a woman.
Because she's a woman, yeah. And people have like a Clinton hangover.
So who are Sanders voters? And who are Warren voters? I mean, can we tell so far from the polling?
I mean, Warren voters are a lot more college educated.
Are they older than Sanders?
Well, Sanders voters are so young that they kind of probably have to be.
Yeah.
Because you can imagine someone who is a pretty hardcore, as Claire's getting to, like, a pretty hardcore Clinton resistance Democrat who's like a baby boomer aged woman who did not like Bernie at all and is totally fine or even quite enthusiastic about Warren. But yeah, there are several things. You know, I mean, like, the whole thing about lanes is, like, there are lanes, but they exist in, like, five-dimensional space or something, where for different types of voters, there are different reasons for having first and second choices. For some voters, they're looking very much at policy, and they're trying to calibrate their views against some weighted average of, you know, where the candidate stands on 10 issues. That probably does exist, not quite that literally, but for some segment of voters, not as much as, like, the kind of media/political science models would assume. For some voters, it's about, are you for the establishment or against the establishment? For some voters, there are still a lot of voters. So ABC News/Washington Post had a poll this weekend where they didn't give you a list of candidates. They just said, okay, open-ended question, who would you vote for the Democratic nomination? In that poll, Sanders was at 11% instead of the 20% that he customarily gets. Biden was at 17 instead of 30. Warren was at 4 instead of 8, right? But it kind of does show you that there is a group of people for whom, if just like when you read off this list of names, then he is one of the familiar names, so he's a kind of a placeholder. And for all these candidates, maybe half the support roughly is people who have actually thought about it and support that candidate. And half of it is just, oh, I've heard that person's name in the news a lot lately, and they seem fine, and this weird person on the phone asked me a question about it. You know, do we mention gender dynamics? I mean, you know, Sanders' supporters are, for Democratic Party, pretty male. By the way, there are in some of these polls more female voters who are undecided. So I wonder if there's almost like a reverse Bradley effect. Bradley effect is the thing that's supposed to happen where voters would claim they were undecided because they were afraid to vote, express their support against a black candidate when they didn't plan to vote for that black candidate, right? I wonder if you almost have the reverse phenomenon here now where, like, I don't know, maybe I'll get myself in trouble, where women are less willing to assert their opinion when it's early in the process and they don't have all the facts in order, right? And so lots of bros are happy to say, oh, yeah, Bernie, Biden, Mayor Pete Beto. But women are like, I'm probably leaning toward Warren or Klobuchar or whomever, but there's no reason for me, Char.
Look at me asserting my opinion about how that name is pronounced.
Slow your roll, okay?
Just Klob.
Okay, how big of a difference is there, though, between male undecideds and female undecideds?
In the ABC poll, it was a pretty big difference. The reason why I'm hedging is because like I haven't looked at that many other polls. Again, to me, it doesn't totally add up that you have these white men doing so well, and so I'm looking for reasons to explain that, right? And one of them might be that like women are more likely to be undecided, or maybe people of color are more likely to be undecided early in the process, whereas white men are not.
That's interesting. We should look at
that.
We will follow up on that punditry, folks.
But it's like,
what are the women thinking?
I guess. What accent was that?
It's my pollster voice.
Oh, God. All polls should be conducted in that voice. I also have this related question when you're talking about how many Sanders supporters overlap with Warren supporters. We don't have a good way to measure this, but we probably still need to ask the question, how much was sexism a factor for some Sanders supporters in 2016? A couple just, you know, quote-unquote data points. One is, I think we all experienced and observed a lot of sexist rhetoric coming from Sanders supporters online. I would not generalize that out to all Sanders supporters, obviously, but it's just like kind of one data point. But to combine that with, you know, there was about, let's say, 20% of Sanders supporters in 2016 who were never Hillary voters, right? Who either didn't vote in the general election or voted for a third party candidate or voted for Trump. Those voters were, on balance, more conservative than Democrats overall. They tended to come from red states. So even though we can't really measure it, I think if we're talking about Warren and Sanders supporters and how much the voters overlap, I do think we have to ask this question of how much of a factor is sexism for some voters, is just gender overall for some voters, and is that acting like a kind of like a guardrail for some voters between those two candidacies?
Maybe this is helpful framing, maybe not. So Bernie goes from 43% 4 years ago to 20% currently in the polls. And maybe we're debating, oh, what is true of that 20%?
Right.
When we should be debating, what about the 23%? Because clearly the 20% are the ones who are the most hardcore Bernie fans. And within that circle, some of them probably are still name recognition, but a lot of them are real big fans, right? How come more of the 23% did not go to Warren?
We actually get this question quite a bit, which is when we talk about this on the podcast or when we talk about it in pieces about sexism in the way that candidates are perceived or the way the media covers them, without fail, we get people tweeting back, well, where's the proof? Where's the evidence? I think that there is sometimes evidence. There are sometimes, you know, in surveys, people will kind of express what, you know, people who run surveys call like, you know, sexist feelings, or they answered it in this way. But I also continue to, like, my answer to people who push back on this and say, where's the stats, is like, you have ingrained sexism that I think isn't always well measured or well expressed in survey data. And so while I understand, I'm just speaking for myself here, I'm going off book. But when
going off book,
I think it's sort of a purposely obtuse question back, you know, where's the data? I don't know. Where's the data in your everyday life about internalized sexism? How does that express itself? It doesn't often express itself in ways that you can, you know, in a newspaper or magazine article say that's sexist and we have the data to prove it. I think sometimes these candidate choices, and whether or not they're framed by gender, are, you know, the reasons are more subtle than people coming out and saying, like, I'm a Bernie bro and I don't like women.
I mean, if you look at polls, where if you look at, like, who do you think is electable and not, right? People clearly think that being a straight white man is correlated with electability. Democrats think that, right? And they think with Bernie, straight white man, but you're also a 77-year-old socialist. Actually, the straight white man part outweighs, which I'm not sure I would agree with, right? I think the political science would probably say that actually being seen as very far left and being kind of proud of that probably is a bigger electoral liability than your gender or than your race. But like, I think Democrats are reluctant to believe that after 2016. And also when, you know, a message you hear a lot, because there's maybe truth in it, is that some degree of Trump support is driven in racial animus. Not maybe, there's definitely some truth that some degree is. We can debate whether it's a large degree or a medium-sized degree, or a small degree. And so people hear that all the time. They're like, okay, well, don't we need like a safe white guy to run against Trump? But then going forward, I wonder if that wears off. Because number one, people are good if they really fall in love in a political way with Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or Mayor Pete or whatever else, right? People are good at coming up with rationalizations for why their candidate is more electable.
You know, it's interesting. Harris, in her stump speech, kind of addresses the electability thing, where she'll say, I'm here to win the, like, that's one of the first things she says. I mean, you would think that, like, de facto, I'm running for president, I'm here to win this. but in this race,
well, in this race, yeah.
A, just a numbers game. She's saying, I'm not just doing it to pad my resume. And B, by the way, I think I have a real path to victory. But it's interesting to me that that's something that she, like, she and her campaign are like, we have to address this.
Yeah. To jump back to the Warren Sanders thing, a lot of Sanders support had an independent, even small C conservative flavor to it.
Yeah.
You know, he did better in states that
Oklahoma.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so when you look at it that way, you know, when you look at it as his support was sort of more about blowing up the system and leveling the playing field, then the lack of overlap with Warren, I think, makes a bit more sense above and beyond the gender stuff, even, or on top of, you know.
Because once again, he's an independent, she's a registered Democrat.
Exactly, right.
All right, well, before we wrap up, I want to answer a few listener questions. We've been getting some great questions as the primary has started to heat up, so let's do that. But before we do, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by 1-800-FLOWERS. After a childhood full of unsuccessful attempts to pull the wool over your mom's eyes, do you really think she wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a last-minute Mother's Day gift and something truly thoughtful? This Mother's Day, don't settle for anything less than the biggest and brightest bouquets from 1-800-Flowers.com. Right now, 1-800-Flowers has great deals for mom, like 24 assorted roses for $24. That's only a dollar per rose. With a bright and beautiful mix of orange, yellow, and pink blooms, these assorted roses are guaranteed to make her smile. Assorted roses are the perfect way to surprise all the moms in your life, whether it's a wife, a sister, a grandma. Roses from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak from premier farms and shipped overnight to ensure freshness. To order 24 stunning roses for $24, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code POLITICS. That's 1-800-Flowers.com, code POLITICS. Order today and save at 1-800-Flowers.com, code POLITICS. This offer expires Friday. As I mentioned, we've received a bunch of good questions from listeners, and every so often we want to take the opportunity to respond to some of them as, you know, the primary carries on. So here we go. Let's start with a question from Harry. Maybe it's Harry Anton. I don't know. Came in on Twitter. The question is, how greatly do you guys expect the first rounds of debates to affect the polling numbers, especially for candidates polling between 4 and 8% currently?
Great question, Harry.
Very greatly. Greatly.
Greatly.
How greatly?
Such a great question. Such a great question.
That is a good question. How? What's the scale of the change that you would expect?
I would expect the first debate to produce one surge.
How big of a surge?
And for whom?
And when and where?
For whom does the bell toll?
Probably for Seth Moulton.
No, what's a surge, though?
What is a surge?
Yeah, like what's the range on a surge?
A Buttigieg surge.
Okay.
Is it like 4 to 8 points or 10 to 20 points or 30 to 40 points?
4 to 8, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is in the model of like the 2012 Republican primary where everyone gets moment.
That's the median expectation, right? Uh-huh. The over-under is a 4 to 8 point surge, right? Buttigieg is actually like a little larger than that. Well, it depends on whether you look at state or national polls. But he's on the high side of that. So I'd expect like a two-thirds Buddha surge.
I think we might see bigger surges and dips than that on the scale of like 12 to 16.
All right. Laying down the expectations. Next question comes in from Steven. He says, with just over 230 days until the Iowa caucuses, how many 2020 candidates do you think will drop out before then?
For Iowa? Steven,
Stephen, have a seat.
Stephen,
we gotta talk.
I need to tell you something about the large egos that it takes to run for president. None of them will drop out, is my prediction, Stephen.
Oh, that's not right.
I'm not buying.
No, because you don't even need to have that much money to just, you can run like a Ben Carson like book tour campaign.
But what if you start feeling shame?
You wouldn't
Galen,
run for president. You wouldn't be in politics.
That is the dumbest question ever asked on this show. Who feels shame in politics these days? Come on.
The first time Joe Biden ran, he dropped out before Iowa.
No.
Hold on. The people who don't have that much, like Yang is going to fund his campaign. I think the ego factor comes in for a lot of people. Like, why would you might drop out like right after Iowa?
I put the over under at.
Maybe Tulsi Gabbard will drop out.
I put the over under at either 3.5 or 4.5, somewhere around there.
I put it at 5 or 5.5. There are a lot of candidates, including some they're going to get in.
Right.
Right. And to some extent, if you're a Tim Ryan or something and you're at 2% and you don't really see a path forward, you don't really have any money, right? Then you don't want to preserve your dignity.
You don't want to be on the ballot and get embarrassed. I'm saying if you think you have a future career, you know, it's like for Tim Ryan or...
Well, we've already had one dropout, technically. Ojeda.
Well, we don't consider him major.
So we have some estimate. Claire says 0. Micah says 3.5 to 4.5.
I'm going bold.
Nate says 5. We'll see what happens.
I'm a believer in the ego.
All right. Next question is, do you think Beto momentum is now lost and his space is occupied by Mayor Pete as the quote-unquote white Obama candidate? Do you think there is space for both Beto and Mayor Pete, or can there only be one?
There can be only one. I do think Buttigieg has stolen some of Beto's thunder.
I think
for
so,
sure.
too.
Yeah.
I think Nate probably disagrees with me on this point, but in general, I think of Beto O'Rourke and Pete Buttigieg as being very similar types of candidates, because I see them as, like, presentation-wise, as, like, the safe, straight, white man who can... speak about sort of progressive social issues.
Except
in a
that
way,
one of them definitely in is. A way,
Hold on, let me finish my point. Speak to red staters or whatever East Coasters' conception of red staters is. I think Nate's argument back to me would be Claire, Pete Buttigieg is different because he is a gay candidate and you can't underestimate that. I think he has more of an uphill fight because we don't have a conception of how people would react to a gay general election candidate. But in general, I think that those two guys are kind of, their whole path to victory, I think, is basically the same. They're kind of going for the same thing.
I don't think they're that similar, really.
Biographically? Or in the nature of their appeal? You get what I mean?
I mean, I think Buttigieg has this much clearer...
Buttigieg
has a much clearer message about, like, I'm trying to kind of bridge the whole red state blue state shtick, right? Like, I may have been Harvard educated, but I'm from a small town in Indiana, right? I may be gay, but I work on everyday issues and people with their
kids
religious. In Little League, and I'm religious, but, like, I'm no Norwegian and stuff like that, right? I think that's a different type of appeal than Beto, who was more of like I call him, again, we use like the beer versus wine track. He's like the macro craft brew track, right? He's like the Sam Adams.
I just think you're really wrong about this. Like, what you're basically, maybe one of them is running a more concise, clear campaign than the other one, but I think they're generally going for the same thing. And I feel like when you're describing this, you're just describing like whose campaign you think is being better run right now.
No, because
but they're actually going for the same kinds of people.
I don't think Beto has a very clear message about like kind of what he's running for other than electability, where I think
Pete Buttigieg.
Vote Pete Buttigieg.
Pete Buttigieg.
Where I think Pete is, you know.
I don't know who are you talking
about. I don't even know anymore.
I think you just proved Claire's point.
Yeah, wait, totally.
I want to make a point. I think you're both, I agree with Claire.
Classic Micah.
I agree with Claire, but I think you're both overcomplicating it. I just think there's a portion of Democrats who want to get really excited about their candidate and it becomes a thing. And I think it was Beto and then it was Mayor Pete. And I think there's only so much space in the media ecosystem and in the electorate for there to be a trendy, hot candidate. And
a celebrity candidate.
Yeah, exactly. And so in that way, you know, I think they are competing.
I think they're different archetypes.
But he's not even making the argument that they are the same candidate. He's just
Micah.
He's just making the argument that there can only be one like celebrity darling of the moment, and so if Pete is going to be the one, then it can't be Beto anymore. That's like
It's not so much about them. It's about the feelings and the dynamics they're tapping into and taking advantage of.
Tingly.
Why can't
Chris Matthews getting tingles down his leg?
Why can't Booker be tingly? Booker,
I mean, he can
be.
He's just not yet. And if he becomes tingly, then Mayor Pete won't be tingly anymore.
Exactly.
I regret introducing tingly.
The tingly lane.
I mean, we also have this issue that, like, I think Mayor Pete has an appeal that is primarily to white voters. Beto comes from a district that is majority Hispanic. And if you look at the issues that he talks about, it's a lot of stuff on, like, criminal justice, on immigration, on education. These are actually issues that historically Hispanic and sometimes black Democrats are more concerned about than white Democrats. And so I think, like, you know, but he might not be kind of actually gaining traction with minorities. He's sort of maybe trying to. I think Mayor Pete's support is going to be quite white, frankly, for a long time in the process. I think as we speak, he's like getting lunch with Al Sharpton today or something.
He is.
But, you know, I think kind of he is kind of the candidate of like white college educated intellectuals / college students. And Beto probably hoped for that group among others, right? But like there are other directions that Beto could go.
All right. Well, that question started its own, a segment unto itself. And I'm sure we will get to more of these questions as the primary wears on, but let's leave it there for now. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
It's great to discuss Pito.
Thank you, Micah.
Pito Buttigieg, if you have a suggestion for what Pito Buttigieg's campaign slogan should be.
Let's like enter this candidate.
Yeah, at 538 Politics.
We sometimes write like this would be
the ideal,
you know, if an algorithm wrote like a stump speech for a Democrat, what would it be? We should name our fake candidate Pito
Buttigieg is like the AI candidate of 538.
Can we do like the perfect stump speech for 538 readers?
Written by Pito Buttigieg?
I don't want to look in that particular mirror.
And again, before we go, we will be in Texas almost all of next week. Former Republic of Texas. Go get your tickets at 538.com/live. Be in Austin and then Houston.
And that's
I'm looking forward. And then that's it.
I'm looking forward to it, too. I've been reading The Path to Power. And so just really
That's why you're looking forward to it?
Yeah, actually. Really excited to be in Hill Country.
Yeah.
To see all that grass that Robert Caro has spilled a lot of ink over.
We're getting there early. I'm going to be there the weekend before. I'm actually staying in a trailer.
Okay. And this is where I'm going to tell Galen to stop talking so that no one axe murders him in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Why are you staying in a trailer?
It looked cool.
The heart wants what the heart wants.
It's Austin.
Even that, which
you gotta
is
do
worse
a, you got to do weird shit in Austin.
I was going to drink beer.
All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you in Texas.